When the art day gets rough, you just gotta keep on punching. And here's your Thunder Punch Daily with Jersey Drozd.
So Baron von Baron, the Case of the Two-Faced Statue, is a fantasy adventure story. And that genre comes with expectations of fantastical locations, right? It's a fantasy. So they're probably going to go to some weird, strange lands. And the three lands, or the three remote and dangerous locations that our heroes go on in the book. And I'm going to attach the map of the world with this, as I made up lots of locations, but the three that the book primarily concerns itself with are the Lost City of Terror, Demon's Deep, and the Crags of Everlasting Ice. Now, those names, I am very aware of how kind of corny and evocative of adventure serials of the 1940s and 50s that those are. And yeah, you bet. I was a child of the 80s. I loved Indiana Jones growing up. I've got mixed feelings about Indiana Jones now, though, which I'll go into at another date. But where this really, the big influence of this comes from my love of the G.I. Joe Real American Hero cartoon, which I also grew up with in the 80s. And it was a Sunbow cartoon. I am the co-host of a Transformers podcast, which is another Sunbow cartoon, where my co-host and I watch an episode of the show and then break down the story and discuss what we think works and what didn't, what worked for us as children, what works for us as adults, and vice versa. So I fell in love with the Sunbow style of storytelling at a pretty early age, and I never shook it. It's something that I've been really, I get a lot of energy from it. It really makes me feel, it's not just nostalgia. I mean, part of it's nostalgia. Part of it is going back to that feeling of being the kid sitting in front of the TV after school with the VCR on, taping it and making sure to pause before commercials come on, because I don't want commercials on my recordings, you know. Part of it's that, but a lot of it is, and I can link to this too, I did a Nerd Night talk years ago where I broke down sort of like five ways this kind of Sunbow style storytelling affected my work. You know, the clarity of character, the interesting solutions to building narrative around things that don't really lend themselves to the narrative, like the Sky Commander's toy. Like I said, you can listen to that if you're really interested, but why am I talking about these locations? Because one thing that I decided at a very early age, I want to say like I was maybe like 19 or 20 years old, and watching the G.I. Joe miniseries, The Revenge of Cobra, which is my favorite one, for like the umpteenth time, I still play it in the background often in the studio. I can recite the whole thing almost verbatim. Because I really feel like it's the second miniseries, and it perfects this sort of storytelling strategy that Ron Friedman came up with. Ron Friedman and Flint Dilley came up with to address this problem of telling a story with dozens and dozens of characters, right? By the time the second miniseries came out, there were a lot of G.I. Joes and a lot of Cobras to deal with. You had Destro the Baroness, Major Blood, Scrap Iron, Firefly, Cobra Commander, you know, Zartan and the Dreadnoks, plus the Cobra Troopers, and plus now you got like Roadblock, you got Flint, you got Mutt and Junkyard. There's just so many characters that how do you tell a story about them, to use Ron Friedman's words, without having them just like walk across the screen all the time, announcing their presence, right? And so we came up with this idea of like, well, let's split them into teams. They have to, whatever MacGuffin they're chasing has many parts, and they got to go all over the world to go find the parts of the MacGuffin. Okay, so in the first miniseries, it was the Mass Device, which was a teleportation device that was fueled by three catalytic elements that were each in remote and dangerous parts of the Earth. In the second miniseries, Destro creates this thing called the Weather Dominator, which gets blown up and gets shot. Its parts get thrown all over the world into three remote and dangerous locations. And the remote and dangerous locations always had these wonderfully silly names, like the Palace of Doom, the Island of No Return, the roof of the world. Okay, you went to the Arctic. Yeah, we went to the roof of the world. In one of the later ones, this is the devil's playground. You know? And even as silly as those sound, you know, in doing my travels, I've come across places that have strange names like that. Like, we all know there's a town in Michigan called Hell, Michigan. If you go to the post office there and you want to send a postcard to somebody, they will actually, as part of the service of the Hell, Michigan post office, will burn the edges of the postcard. So it'll be like greetings from hell. When I went to Death Valley, California, we found one of the different parts of the national park there was called the Devil's Golf Course. Right? And it's because it was so bumpy and the terrain was so bad with all like the salt flats and like these weird rock formations that it's like, obviously, the only way that anybody would play golf there is if it was literally in hell, kind of thing. So it's not like these funny mythical names don't make it into real life. But why three and why the funny kind of language around the names? Well, three, not to get all scholarly about it, and that's one of the themes of the book, too, is like this sort of dichotomy between Baron von Baer and Gellius Lugubrius. And Baron von Baer is the scholar, and Gellius Lugubrius is the practitioner. I'll go into that in a future essay. But not to get too pleased with myself because I read a few books, but three is something that happens in a lot of kinds of mythology and mythology-like storytelling. You'll have somebody do something, they did it once, and they did it twice, and then on the third time, things change. Third time's a charm, right? This idea of threes turns up a lot in these kinds of stories, and I like that kind of... I like pointing to things that feel universal, if I can, even if it's feels a little bit constructed, like in this case. Well, I'm just going to arbitrarily pick three. Well, that's what happened in G.I. Joe, and I loved it. But also, when I think about these names... it feels somehow, if I could fuse these two ideas together, in my mind, the way it makes sense is that it's like cartoonishly mythical. It's pointing to something primal, but with a funny kind of elevated language. And I mean funny in the sense of it's charmingly whimsical. I've talked about this elsewhere, but like, I think about, when I'm writing these kinds of stories, I'm thinking about how I experienced the world as a child and how did the world feel to me. And a memory that feels very primal to me is being afraid to go down into the basement. When I was a kid, we had a house in the country. We had a basement. It wasn't a finished basement. It wasn't like what people call, for better or worse, man caves. Didn't have carpeting. It was just like concrete walls, you know, the cinder block walls and a concrete floor. And there was a furnace. There was the washer and the dryer. And then there was a bunch of stuff in storage, right? There wasn't much reason to go down there. There was no celebrated activity. As a matter of fact, the only time we ever really went to the basement as a family was when there was a tornado warning, right? So it was a space that got really associated in my mind with mystery, darkness, and also... you know, hiding from the monster kind of thing. A tornado's going to come and it could just tear away everything that you care about. So you got to go hide here, turn all the lights off and play charades with your family until the all clear is sounded, right? And so in a kid's mind, because we don't have the context, and I mean, actually, you know, there's a television show that I would point to that really does, I think, a great job of describing how a child's imagination goes wild without the context of having lived very long is the Arthur PBS TV series. The way Arthur's mind will conjure an image of like, what's this gonna be like? All right, this is something you see in also in a lot of the He-Man cartoon is the young characters and even some of the adult characters will often say, what's going to happen? Like they say that specific line. And I think about that's something kids are always wondering, what's going to happen next? I don't know, I'm not in control. I'm this little tiny thing living in this world of all these grown-ups who are always telling me what to do. What's going to happen? And without the context, you know, all I know is that the basement is, it's dark, smells kind of funny, and it doesn't seem very comforting. There aren't the trappings of comfort like furniture and carpet and curtains and, you know, warm light. It's a light bulb with a string, you know? And so this can kind of without the context, all sorts of images came to mind of what was going to happen when I went in the basement. Oh, also the stairs. The stairs to the basement were just wooden planks on, you know, like a scaffolding to hold the wooden planks kind of thing that wasn't finished. So I remember thinking like something could be underneath the stairs and could reach through and grab me from behind kind of thing, grab my ankle from behind. Some were underground in a basement. There could be something on the other side of those bricks, something dead, something that's been there for a long time, and something that wants to come out, right? That's the kind of like primal kind of fear and wondering that can happen in a kid's head. And I want my book to, as a fantasy adventure with like a heavy emphasis on like spookiness, I want to lean into that kind of feeling. And I think that these kinds of locations, the Palace of Doom was clearly like some kind of, I'm talking about G.I. Joe now, some kind of South American temple, whether it was Aztec or Mayan, wasn't really clear. I don't think they meant it to be very clear. It's just, it's like, to us American kids who weren't exposed to very much at the time, it's just supposed to be exotic and ancient, right? And inside the temple was this giant, literally 40-foot tall stone figure sitting on a throne with like an angry face, kind of the kind of faces you see on like threshold guardians in certain kind of temples, right? And as soon as the Joes come in to try to find the MacGuffin they're looking for, the thing gets activated by some kind of brick or a trap or a tripwire or something like that. And this giant stone monster comes to life and starts chasing them around, right? And so this is where we get into this idea of these sort of cartoonishly mythical places are a place where the rules change. When the Joes are at their base back in Springfield, Illinois, or wherever their base is in the cartoon, you don't see giant stone monsters walking around. You have to go to the remote and dangerous location for the rules to change and for things to happen that are unexpected. In one of the miniseries, they go deep into this place and they have, like, they encounter these giant worm monsters, and G.I. Joe has to work with Cobra against their common enemy. Right, the rules changed. Cobra's not our enemy here. There's a bigger enemy here, kind of thing. So it's a place where you can kind of, when I say cartoonishly mythical, I mean that it changes the rules of disbelief in my mind. It's a place where you can kind of go wild with something really unexpected happening. And I think there's something in us that just expects that feels comfortable with that idea. Only the most rigid of us are going to say, well, how come when they go to this place, snakes talk? When they go to that place, snakes don't talk, right? I think at least for me, this is how it works in my head, is it feels like it's a boundary around a mystical place where you're entering another zone kind of thing. And giving it that cartoonishly elevated name kind of points in that direction. It's also, and this goes to mythology and less to G.I. Joe, this is something that I brought to Baron Von Behr, is that these spaces were specifically designed to be places for character transformation. Mythical zones, mystical zones, these places where the rules change and unexpected stuff happens, is like now we're entering the world of the psyche. These are not just giant stone robot monsters. They are... And this is like how, you know, certain psychologists talk about interpreting fairy tales. I think it was Marie-Louise von Franz, the sort of compatriot of Carl Jung, talked about this idea of like interpreting a fairy tale the way you would interpret a dream, where all the characters are represented of the story's unified psyche. So the king represents this part of the psyche, the princess this part, the dumbling this part, etc., right? And even the horse represents a certain part of the psyche, right? So these spaces become a place where the lines blur between whether this opponent is a physical opponent stopping the hero from achieving their quest, getting their MacGuffin or whatever, but also it's part of them, right? I do not have any expectation, hope, or desire that 11-year-olds are going to get that, because that's not the point. The point is that they receive it. The same way I received this stuff as a child, the way I knew I felt scared and uncomfortable in certain kinds of stories, but I didn't have the words to explain it, but I was receiving something on an emotional level, right? That as I got older and I was like, that's still ringing around inside of me and I don't know why. And then I can process and go, oh my gosh, yes, that's the story of like the transformation that happens deep inside the monster. The character falls into the whale or whatnot. There's lots of stories where a character goes into a big monster, comes out, and is different. On the one hand, it's a 19-year-old me saying, I love the elegance of the three remote and dangerous locations. I want to do a book that does that someday. I literally said that. I said it a lot when I was 19 and 20 years old. I told all my friends, like, someday I'm going to do, because I think the term graphic novel was in existence at that time, but it wasn't widely used, and the model of making graphic novels was not proven yet. So I remember having this idea in my head at the time. Remember, this is like 1994, 1995. The internet was still pretty new. The manga explosion hadn't quite happened yet, although manga was over here in the United States. But the climate of the world of comics, as was visible to me, was the monthly magazine sold in specialty stores. We were seeing less and less of it in grocery stores or at 7-Elevens, the way I had been collecting them as a child. But I remember having this fantasy of someday, it would be wonderful if we lived in a world where you could do a 250-page comic, perfect bound, about the size of a paperback book. And if I remember right, Gil Kane actually, I'm kind of going on a tangent here, but I think Gil Kane tried something like that. Like, and I really wanted it to be printed on like that really rough and kind of acidy paperback paper that turns super yellow over time. Because I wanted it to be, my image was that the package would imply cheap, thrilling read. Don't get too overwhelmed around how important this literature is. This is meant to be fun, right? But anyway, that's not really super pertinent to the story. But the story is that like I told my friends at the time, I'm like, someday I'm going to do a 200-page book with three remote and dangerous locations like those G.I. Joe miniseries, and it's going to be awesome. And now here I am, 27 years later, finally doing it. Oh my gosh, sometimes these gestation periods, it's like worse than an elephant, right? So I've wanted to do it for that long, but the reason it took 27 years is it took me that long to really process why I was responding to it that way. There's a perfect example. It was something that I received emotionally. It's like, that feels like truth to me. That feels right. That feels correct. I feel activated when I encounter this structure. Now I'm, as an older adult, an aging adult, I don't know what you would call it. I'm middle-aged now. I've had time to build some context around that and some experience that like corresponds to things and I've read some books and I suddenly realized, oh, okay, there's a reason I think that this hit me the way it did. Now I can do it with a little bit more thought behind it than just simply aping it. But there's a level of aping. There's a level of me just saying like, boy, Ron Friedman and Flint Dilley did something cool. I want to do that too. And then there's another level where I'm like, well, I'm going to put my little spin on it, where I'm going to add like an extra level of really trying to infuse it with my own childhood terrors and imagination around places that don't feel welcoming to me and what I could imagine could happen in them. There we go. That was what I was trying to get at succinctly. A mystical place. When I was a child, felt like a place where I did not feel welcomed. I felt like it had something inherently antagonistic about it. If not antagonistic, maybe implacable. Implacable might be the word. Something where it's like, it's not saying like, oh, I'm so glad you're here. It's saying, do you dare enter here, right? And then without the context of knowing what's going to happen, because I was a child and I didn't know it was going to happen yet, you know, all of the scary images that would come to mind. I wanted to bring that energy into my three remote and dangerous places. So there's an element of joy. There's an element of terror. And, you know, I think that that's another reason why this book means so much to me, is that I feel like it's a more thorough exploration of all the emotions that I get from stories that move me. And I hope the book moves you. And you can find out more about the book at baronvonbear.com. Baron as in the title of nobility, von as in from, and bear as in the animal. He's a teddy bear. He's a teddy bear who's a baron, Baron von Bear. And that's where you can find, you know, call to action items like sign up for the mailing list to find out more about the project or even pre-order the book. And thanks to everybody who does go there and hits those action items. And if these topics, these discussions, they're not discussions, there's nobody else in the room, just me. Well, it's a discussion in my head, isn't it? It's a whole bunch of different parts of me all hacking away at an idea. If they're interesting to you and you would like to wonder about some aspect of them or some other part of making comics, you can go to jdrozd.com/AMA or baronvonbear/AMA. Both places will take you to the same form. It's confidential. You can just type out a wondering thing you're wondering about, little optional piece of context asking, like, why are you asking me this? And then I will bring it to another Thunder Punch Daily essay. And until the next one, remember, everybody.
Today we saw Professor Smolin find a great treasure. It wasn't gold or jewels, but something even more precious, knowledge. There are many places to find knowledge, and one of the easiest and best is a museum. Museums are storehouses of knowledge where you can see and learn all sorts of fascinating things. There's probably one close to you, so pay a visit. Remember, knowledge is power, and you can get the power.